Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. I'm going to skip the regular intro today because this episode is extremely content rich. Today we visit with Anna Meredith of Bridge Creek Birch Syrup, both in the Birch Grove and in the Sugar Shop, to discuss the process of making syrup. Lynn Whitmore of Ketchumek Moose Habitat, Inc. and Matt James of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District talk about moose habitat conservation and restoration. And Nicole Arevalo has your weekly roundup of events and opportunities in local agriculture. I'm your host, Desiree Hagen. Let's get started.
So this is the bottom connection of the whole main line, basically the plumbing of the whole forest. So once we get up there, it'll make sense, like how it's all connected so that all the sap comes right to these tanks.
But and this part is gravity fed?
Yeah, it's all gravity fed. And a lot of syrup operations like maple are all tubing that are all gravity fed, but we are all human powered. So the crew is up there with 5 and 4 gallon buckets. So all the sap that's coming here is hand hauled to the hoppers and to the main line, makes it to the tank. And once we get up to the sugar shop, it'll make more sense what we do with all that volume and liquid. There's 13 hopper barrel setups in the woods, and we're putting more and more hoppers so that people aren't hauling sap too far. So started with maybe like 7 up here, but now we have a lot more hoppers.
How long is this main line?
It's a great question for Jake. I don't know, a couple hundred yards maybe. But 2-inch main line, we've had to increase the size of the main line because some springs, you know, with all the ice buildup, this one came on hot and quick, but the ice will back us all up. So now we're up to a 2-inch main line, so we have good flow. And filter systems are super important in the whole operations.
2-inch PVC pipe?
Pretty much. And then it goes up to, at the very top of the grove, it's only 3/4 because there'll only be one person, you know, collecting the highest point. But everybody's are flowing into this one main line right now. All right, let's head up. It's greening up every morning we come up. It's greening up. Pretty cool to see the nettles are about to pop. So there are a bunch of volunteers up here, so you're welcome to chat with them too if you'd like.
Geez, I'm realizing I am out of shape.
Me too. The
grove will really do it.
She puts us in shape every spring.
Certain days there's more flow.
Yeah, the weather is the biggest determinant. Yesterday was like our first day. We've had one rainy day, which was great for the trees, and then yesterday was overcast at least, and the changes in the pressures really help. These hot summer light days are pretty rough on sapping, but it's been good even with that. So this is like the first of the filtration. This is just the larger matter we'll filter out with this screen. Then It'll go through at least 10 more filter systems, and it gets to a final filter press, which no matter gets through pretty much. So
I know that when you sell the birch syrup, you have early runs and late runs. So is this the early season?
Yep. So we're still in early run, and we determine that at the end of every day. We go from collecting sap in the morning to birch syrup every night, and that's, we just repeat the cycle every day. And then we test it at the end of the day, visually and most particular by taste. I just said to Jake last night, I think we're on the later end of early run as of last night. So that just means the lightest, it's mostly sucrose, just the first sap out of the tree in the season. And, you know, when you hold it up in the light, our syrup, it's gonna be like a ruby red, pretty beautiful color. And then the mid run will start up early next week, and it'll just get darker, richer, more bold flavor, and the sugars start to convert too. And then the late run will be like our last week of the season, if we have that long of a season. The weather determines our season too. So we always hope for like a 20-day season. And we're on day 8 today.
When you say the sugars convert, they convert into?
So they go to glucose and fructose primarily, and then there'll be a little bit of sucrose in there too. And so that compared to maple's all sucrose, so it's very sweet. Whereas birch can get kind of like a savory flavor to it also. So a lot of chefs and, you know, people smoking or grilling any meats, they're using mostly the late run because it's a bolder, richer flavor and it's more complex sugars. So yeah, good call. This is still early run. And then, so what's happening when it starts to get into the mid-run is the sap will start to get a little darker. Right now it just looks like pure water, because it pretty much is, aside from the vitamins, minerals, sugars, electrolytes, which you can't see. But it'll start to darken up. That's an indicator we're switching runs. And it starts to do that when the sun is feeding the tree. The tree's energizing itself by pulling all of the sugars, the minerals, everything up from its roots, so that it can pop its buds out to start photosynthesis. So it's pretty much going from osmosis to photosynthesis, and we are trying to capture that little window in between. Because once the buds come out, the flavor gets really not great for humans. That's when you stop and you wrap it up.
I don't want to reveal anything about where this geographically is, mm-hmm. but we are in Homer city limits.
Yeah, and on the East End Bench is where the only birch trees, the only birch groves in Homer are on the East End Bench. That's just the natural layout of Homer. We don't have a lot of birch trees. Up north, there's tons. Nanilchik, I've been working with Project Grad, and we've been skiing through the birch grove up there. I'm like, oh, yeah, look at all these trees. We were lucky in Homer to have some groves, but we do not have a lot.
Do you rotate the years that you tap these trees?
Nope. You can tap straight through, but they have a shorter span of when we'll tap. So about like 10 years with birch is good to call it a season for the trees. And we've collected that data and information mostly from up north. Kahiltna Birch Works been making birch syrup for over 30 years in Alaska, longer probably than anyone in North America really. So we get a lot of information from them and their colleagues. And so we are on, I don't even know exactly this grove, maybe the fourth or fifth year. And so when we're tapping, the whole tapping process looks like guesswork, but there is a lot informing the trees that we choose. Kind of doing an 8 to 9 inch minimum.
Of the trunk.
Yep, of the trunk of the tree. Yep, the diameter. And so you don't tap smaller than that. You want to look at the diameter, and then you right away want to look up and see the health of the tree. So if there's a lot of foliage potential, because that's going to be feeding the photosynthesis, it's going to help feed the tree. But then also if there's any damage, like birch will crack pretty easily. So if there's major cracks in them, we leave them be. Typically if there's too many dead branches, we'll leave them be. So if there's any sign of weakened or jeopardized immunity, we typically won't do it. So we're just looking for the healthy trees.
I see that the taps are on all different sides of the tree. Where do you choose to actually drill in?
When we first start out with a grove, the southern exposure is, you know, they're going to get the most heat and sun exposure. So that's going to be like the xylem veins that are going to be the most productive. So we'll do that side. But then every year when you tap, you want to move away from the tap that you did last year. And it's going to heal up completely. Like we can look at any of these trees and look at holes from previous years. And it's healed all the way out. So it's flush with the trunk.
How far do you drill in?
Maybe I have a tap I can show you. So these are the taps. Jake, what's the length on these taps?
The length
Yeah, ish.
2 inches?
A couple inches. So when you do drill in, yeah, we go pretty shallow. I'm not the scientist to speak to. There's plenty of scientists in town who could explain this anatomically. So we're going in, I mean, we're just going as shallow as the tap, and then we're pulling the pulp out. All the equipment we use is from the maple industry, because there's hardly a birch industry in the world. So, and I grew up making maple syrup with my dad, who's up here in the Grove. So now he just came for 3 weeks to do the season with us.
Pretty fun. So you're from the East Coast originally?
Yeah, I was born here and then raised on a dairy farm in Western New York State. Between milkings, we'd go collect sap, which was pretty fun. And then it was a big family event to have it boiling down all day. My grandpa would watch the evaporator usually. Yeah, and we used a tractor and wagon there for all the collection. So all us little cousins would run out and collect it and spill a ton, I'm sure, and get it into the wagon and the tractor, or I'm sorry, the tank in the wagon and pulled by the tractor. So that was how that operation worked, whereas here it's all humans and then the truck. And then a lot of our Amish neighbors would use horse-drawn. That wasn't uncommon. Yeah, there's lots of ways to collect the sap.
Were there any other main differences between the maple harvest and this birch harvest?
Yeah, so absolutely. We had to learn that once we started doing this a decade ago. The behavior of the trees is different. So once the maple starts, she'll shut down at night typically and then start back up with the heat of the day. And whereas the birch, once she starts running, she just doesn't stop. It'll slow maybe if we get super hot days. And then it'll flow harder on the super rainy, nasty spring days, which we love. They're great for sapping. So yeah, the behavior is way different. And then the sugars, for when it comes to actually producing the syrup and marketing it, the sugars are way different. When people compare like the cost or the flavors, or, like, they're just two very different creatures. And you can use them both the same way. Maybe you can use birch a little more diverse because it's, you know, got the different sugar complexities.
With wine, they talk about a terroir, and with oysters, they talk about a miroir, like kind of the taste of the place. Uh-huh. Is there a difference in the taste of birch syrup here than, say, Fairbanks or?
Yep, that's right. I've never heard those terms. That's cool. So yeah, that's a different part of marketing it too, is helping customers understand like that our trees, they're all of the Kenai subspecies. And there are some Kenai up in Talkeetna. The nearest commercial producer is Kahiltna Birch Works up in Talkeetna. And so we're the only ones on the peninsula. So our syrup's going to taste different than everybody in the world because we have our local soil, which has its own different mineral. And a big difference also, you'll see at the sugar shop, is how we make it. And we're all wood-fired. Consistency from like diesel heating is going to be way different than ours. We will drop temp when we're filling up the evaporator with wood, and then we'll bring it back up to a raging boil, and that we're doing that all day long. And I think that gives it a really nice, like a richer, deeper caramel flavor, but not better or worse, just different.
That's the sound of it flowing?
Yeah.
How many people work on this operation?
So it's just Jake and I, is we kind of make it all happen. And then we could probably not do that though without our buddies who are just interested in, I don't know if it's the manual labor or, no, probably not. It's because of this beautiful birch grove, I think. They just like being outside first thing in the morning. It's pretty nice, you know, to do the menial, like physical labor and just put your head down and be in the quiet birch grove. Well, last year was COVID year, so everything was different. But typically, the year before that, we had about 40 volunteers. So cool that folks are into it. When we first started out, it was hard to find people who were even interested in talking about making birch syrup. But now a lot of people are interested, or we found those folks. But we'll typically have a crew of 4 to 5 volunteer helpers. And every time they haul sap in the morning, they get a bottle of syrup in trade.
Ooh, I want to volunteer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like a lot of work, though.
Yep. It's a lot of work, but I like to think it prepares me for the hunting season, you know, in the fall. And a lot of our crew are fishermen, so they're just getting ready for their, you know, summer season. So they're getting their land time in. It's quite a gift that we're able to do it. You can try and see if any of them will talk. No, no. How'd it go? Desiree was asking why we have helpers.
Why do people
help?
Why do people help? For fun. Good times in the grove every morning.
Oh, some people go to church. This is my dad, Mike.
Desiree?
Hi.
Hello.
Mike Meredith. Maple guy.
I finished my sugared season in Western New York, and then we get a ticket and come up and start another sugaring season.
It's another big difference. Maple goes first, and then when maple pretty much wraps up, birch seasons are starting around North America. We went to the first international birch syrup conference at Cornell University put on at Paul Smith up in the Adirondacks. Producers from all over the world there. The goal of the conference was to encourage maple producers in North America to extend their season into the birch industry. But once they just got done with a huge season, it's a pretty hard sell. Big difference is that the maple sugar content is more than double birch sugar content. So we need to haul more than double the amount of sap to get the same amount of syrup. The cost reflects that as well, but it's a hard sell to maple guys. So
you harvest maple syrup in the winter?
Our season starts March 1st, approximately. Last week of February, first week of March, and it runs for 3 weeks, about like this, 3 weeks.
It's changing with the climate majorly right now.
Once in a while, we get a run in early February, and sometime in January, but you don't want that because you tap and you make sugar for a week and then everything freezes up, winter comes back, and then when it starts again in March, the hole's healed over, so you're not going to get good flow. Oh, you want a cold right up until the season starts, and then good weather for 3 weeks to 4 weeks to make your crop. We hit 80% of our crop this year. I saw yesterday Vermont this year only made 40% of their crop.
So that'll affect the market big time.
Everything's Mother Nature related. Here and there, it's the same thing. You need good weather, sugar and weather.
What determines the amount of sugar in the water?
Well, a maple tree has a huge canopy, and they're this big around. So they got to make a lot of sugar to survive the winter and start the next season before chlorophyll. That's what it's doing. And the sugar is stored energy to bring the leaves on before the trees can make their own chlorophyll, their own sugar. So, I mean, you got a huge tree you got to support. And even when the tree's small, I mean, the canopy's big compared to these trees. It takes a lot to keep those, to fire them up again. 6 months a year, they're dormant. So, I mean, they got to store energy to keep the tree going all year. You know? And maples, that's why sugar maples are what they are. They're 2% to 2.5% sugar versus these are 1.
Or 0.9 to 1, pretty much.
In state of Washington, there's a big leaf maple, and it's only 1%. Different trees have different DNA, so that's why sugar maples were always so famous, because they were the best trees to make sugar out of.
Major producers.
So does that mean that for every 100 gallons of birch water, you get 1 gallon?
Yep.
Of sap.
That's right.
Or of syrup.
In theory, I mean, there's, give and take, but yep.
And with maple, I'd get 2 gallons, see, or more. When you go from 2 to 2.4, big improvement. And then that's why we have RO. Jake runs an RO, reverse osmosis, to take 90% of that water, 93% of that water out with the RO.
Does the sugar content vary from year to year?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you know any factors that determine the sugar?
We guess.
There's a lot of theories.
Yep.
I thought I just saw that moose over on that ravine, but I don't think so. I think it was just a cluster of trunks. Somebody will start on the lower part of the grove, and then we kind of meet in the middle. And then you're like, all right, that was quick.
And the ones that are carrying children or have children stay on the bottom, and that works out.
How long does it take you every day?
That was kind of the core crew right there, so that's like 5 people, and it's like an hour and a half. And then we also have folks over in Grove 2 collecting separately, so that we can get up to 1,000 gallons a day, is the goal kind of. And we want to get it all started through the reverse osmosis before noon, just to get the process going. It's sweet with this microphone, you hear a lot more of the sounds that we can't hear.
Yeah.
I can't think of any more questions.
Well, once you're in the sugar shop, that's like the whole, there's a lot up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
We want to get going?
Sure. Yeah.
So right now we are in the sugar shack.
Sugar Shop, Bridge Creek Birch Syrup Sugar Shop. Or my in-laws call it the evaporatorium.
What's that background noise that we're hearing?
That's the reverse osmosis machine. And it's been working for about 3 hours already today. It's got about another hour to go, and then a whole wash cycle. There's a lot going on.
Can you walk us through the process?
Yeah. Okay, so this is where it starts. We'll get two loads of sap from two different groves, and we'll haul them up the hill with the sap wagon. Then we offload all of that into these four cubes. Once everything's here on site, everything kicks off in the sugar shop. The sap is here by noon every day. It takes from about 8 to noon to get the sap here. The shop takes approximately 9 hours after that for the whole process before we have birch syrup, finished product, cleaned up, organized, ready to start over the next morning. So we offload, we use a lot of pumps because we're moving a lot of volumes of liquid. So we're offloading all the sap and it goes into a couple of these tanks. And then you'll see this line that goes into the sugar shop. So we're gonna go back in to the reverse osmosis machine. So this is the RO that Jake built about 5 years ago. We had trouble getting one shipped up to Alaska, so he actually had to build it himself. After we're done running it through the reverse osmosis, we take it up to about 5% sugar. And so our main thing that we're doing is we're saving a ton of fuel, which is awesome. We're wood-fired, so we're saving cords of wood. And when we built this, everything went about 200% efficiency, went up, so that was awesome.
What does the reverse osmosis actually do?
Magic. It's got a high-pressure pump, so it runs the sap across a membrane, and then the only thing that can go through the membrane is pure water. You get pure water coming out the middle of the membrane, and you get the concentrate, which is the sugars and the minerals, flowing back to a tank, and then we circulate on that and takes out the bulk of the water.
I don't think that I've asked you to introduce yourself.
So. Oh, I'm Jake. Yep. And I'm very distracted at the moment, but I'm still here.
You're the other half
I'm the other half, yeah.
So. Operation.
After it goes through the RO, which is a continual thing, it goes back out to the tanks. And it's really important, this whole process, that it's clean and cool. Like, that's the best way to make high quality sap. So you can see down here, these two tanks, see how they're a darker color? So that's the concentrate. And it's a deeper color because it's the 5% sugar content now. And so the far tank is the permeate, which is just straight water. So then we have the concentrate out there. And when we're ready, we get the evaporator fired up. We have a little leftover from the night before, so we're ready to fire everything up and bring it to temp. So then we use a pump and we're bringing the concentrate into the sugar shop along the ceiling, which I'm pointing at and you can't see. And then it runs up to this holding tank. And the holding tank is gravity fed for the next 4 hours into the evaporator. And the evaporator is a 2x6 foot evaporator with a hood, about a 7-inch smokestack, and I don't know, about a 7-inch steam stack also. So we can look in the back here. All right, so when the sap, the concentrate, when it gravity feeds in, we're trying to bring it at the highest temperature into the back pan so the whole process isn't losing heat. And so you'll see this right here. This is a drip pan, the copper coils, the sap's going in at a high temperature, and any of the excess water that's dripping off that, we have a runoff right here. So this is, again, just water. Anywhere we can save the process of having to steam that water off, we're just being more efficient. And so again, this is hot water for cleanup or whatever we need it for. So you can look in there, or maybe as much as you dare hold the microphone close to that, it's just raging boil down.
Oh gosh.
When Project Grad brought the Ninilchik students here on last week, they said it just was like cream soda, natural cream soda. I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
So I'll explain what's happening in the pans, which we can't visually see. So this is a top-down view of on our sticker here, or on our hats. So these are the two back pans. It's running north and south, so it's dripping in. And in here, it's a drop flue pan. We had both the pans made for us by some maple guys back east. Everything else Jake has made with local friends here in town. As the water is evaporating off, the sap's concentrating even more. And so it gravity feeds itself from the back pan, and then it pushes itself through to the front pan. And so this is where it's getting closer to syrup, and that's why the color gradient changes. So as it moves through the front pan with gravity, it's getting closer and closer to birch syrup, finished product. And then I'll show you the last process where we draw it off.
That is so cool that your logo is a diagram of how it works, a primitive diagram.
Yeah, we drew it on a napkin at a local bar. Every 15 minutes or so, what, 5 minutes? Woo. So every 5 minutes or so, we're loading up that burner and we're filling the wood box and keeping at a raging boil the entire day. But every time we open the door, we're losing temperature, so now she rages back up, and sometimes it can totally foam over, and then it's not good, so we try to make sure that doesn't happen. So we keep an eye on it. So there's always about 7 little jobs going on at the same time, which is why Jakey's not gonna be chatting too much. He's keeping an eye on all of it.
So when we drove up here, we saw the smoke.
Smoke and steam.
The steam.
Yep.
The smoke and steam.
Yep.
There's
yep.
two
stacks.
Yeah.
So they're gonna see the black smoke coming out right here. And then, yeah, the white steam coming out. Yep. So they're both working together.
And what did you call this roof?
Cupola. I think it's cupola or something actually, but it's just so it's open on 4 sides so that the steam can roll out. We designed the sugar shop for this operation, but we also, in the fall, we harvest and process all of our game and domestic animals in here, and it's pretty tiny. And sugar shacks for the maple industry are also very small, and they're often wood-fired back home, back east too. Again, we're pretty minimal with our whole operation. Every year we've gained a piece of equipment, which makes us more and more efficient, and it's reflected in the syrup. I mean, it's a lighter, it's pure flavor, so.
Okay, so these 3 chambers that we have on top that are heating up and producing deeper colors.
In the front pan?
In the front pan.
Yeah, let's look at that.
And then that pan right there, the one closest, is that's when you actually extract?
The syrup pan, it's the front pan, it's just flat, and it comes down, there's 3 bays with limbers on each bay, so that you get a sugar gradient going, you know, as you're diluting in the back and evaporating in the front, all your sugars will end up in the front of the thing. So we've got a thermometer probe in the front bay, and we're just watching the temperature, because syrup today is 223.5 degrees. So if it hits that, open the valve, get rid of what's up to that temperature until the temperature goes down, and then close the valve and wait for it to heat up again. Meanwhile, stoking the fire and running the RO and listening to music, I guess.
Does it have to get to a certain temperature, or do you have to keep it below a certain temperature?
Yeah, that's kind of the funny misconception with birch. People think that you can't get it very hot or else it'll burn. So low and slow is the technique, but really, like with a setup like this, the hotter you get it and the faster you get it in and out of the heat, you're gonna keep a lot of the nuances of the flavor instead of just boiling it down to sludge, which is still good, but this way we're just getting it in and out as fast as possible.
Slow and low is not the tempo?
Yeah, I mean, it's way different than maple. So how it behaves, just like the trees behave differently, the sap and the sugar behaves differently too. So with birch, it is more finicky and it has a lower burn point.
You know, we're at 22.6 right now. We've been burning for 5 minutes and 30 seconds after the last fire, and so I really got to get some wood in there fast. And there's the alarm going off telling me that I better get that stuff out of there, else it's going to burn in about 5 seconds. So you open the valve. So we got good syrup coming off the end, because you know it's 223.2, which is fine. Now it's going down because I'm pulling concentrated syrup off, and there's diluted stuff coming in from the back of the sugar gradient, flooding it out. So now I'm down to 221. I'm gonna let it roll a little bit because my last reading was a little high on the sugar, so I'm gonna dilute it down a little bit to get my syrup right to 67 degrees Brix, which is where we want it. And I shut the valve, and now I'm gonna shut the fan off for the evaporator, which is the blower, because it's a forced air evaporator. Now I'm gonna open the door, and I'm gonna load it up with wood. set the timer so we know how long it's been. We're 221, so we're safe. So I'm gonna look at the RO and then go deal with that. Yeah, and we made like a, you know, probably just pulled a quart, maybe a little more of syrup off there. So there you go, nothing to it, simple.
The syrup that you siphoned off, is there another process after that?
Yeah, there's a whole nother side to it that I can explain in a minute, but I'm gonna go
do your thing.
Did you hear that change in the sound?
Yeah, what is that?
So, I mean, this is getting closer to syrup, so you can actually look at the bubbles, see the difference in the boiling. So it's getting a lot more, you can tell by the visually, it's just more gloopy. So we just keep an eye on it, we know it's getting closer. So it's raging boil in the front and back pan, so that just means everything's working well. So yeah, with the slow and low isn't the tempo. As we've been learning for the past decade, our final product used to be a lot more caramelized, so a lot deeper, richer, darker syrup. And now it's a lot lighter, more delicate. You still get the different nuances coming out in the flavors, but it's just a different product now. That's mostly because we've become more efficient and just the way that we're handling the sap. It's really cool that our community has stood with us as we've learned how to make the best syrup that we can, because to have it in the raw it's an acquired taste. But now, I mean, our syrup pretty much talks for itself. It's so good. Like, that's a lot of people try it and they're like, I've never tasted anything like that ever before.
Can you talk about the next step in the process
after we draw off? Yeah, so that's the four stations. The final station is the finishing station, so we can go over there.
How much wood do you think you go through in a season?
My efficiency's going up, so. Used to burn a lot more, but we make about 30 gallons of syrup per cord right now of dry spruce. So we burn, I don't know, we'll probably go through 5 or 6 cords maybe this year, depending on how long it goes. But it just depends. There's so many variables, you know. That's pretty, yeah.
What's that foam?
What is that foam? That's the float valve that keeps the sap level in the evaporator a constant. As the level goes down, it opens up the valve. It's a direct correlation with how much is coming in, how much is going out. It always stays the same, because if there was an imbalance, not enough, it would just be epic disaster instantly. It's hot in there, it's probably 1800 degrees at least with the forced air. So it's walking a fine line. There's about a half an inch of syrup, in that front layer. But as long as you keep that layer there at the right level, it will never burn. It's that insulating factor. So it works. It's a little sketchy, it's running pretty hot. The wood makes it an adventure because you get big fluctuations in heat and you got to open the door and it cools down and then you got to load it up and it fires back up. So it makes it exciting. Like, I'm at 224 right now. It's kind of hot.
Did you grow up with syrup culture?
No, I didn't. Anna did, but I didn't. We used to do it, my mom and I did it when I was like 12 or 15 or something. We poked a few trees and cooked it down on the stove and made some kind of syrup. It was fun. So yeah, I'm dumping this. This is what we just pulled off, which is probably a good gallon or so into that holding tank. And then sits there for a while. Then I got propane burners under it, and today I'll probably do about 10 gallons. So you get the 10 gallons sitting there and I'll turn the burner on, get it up to temperature, and then start the filtering process. I guess 5 minutes only gives me not quite enough time to explain something.
Do your thing. That's more important.
The filtering process is, we store it, we get it up to temperature, which is, around 185. Try to keep it hot, because if you let it cool down and then bring it back up to temperature, you get a bunch of different suspended solids that come back out of it. Every time you reheat it, you get more sediment. So we get it up to temperature and we try to keep it up to temperature. Goes into here, and then we add diatomaceous earth, which is like a filter aid. What that does is it absorbs a lot of the particulates in the syrup. You know, there's a bunch of sugar nitre that comes out, calcium, and all this sediment that manifests when you heat it up. You get all this sludge in there that you got to get out. So the diatomaceous mixes with that, and then we pump it through this filter press pump, and we bring it up to pressure, and it runs through a filter press, which is basically like a stack of hollow plates with filter papers in between that catch the diatomaceous earth and forms a cake, which is pulled out of there this morning, you know? So the diatomaceous actually gets caught in these, in between the papers, and the syrup gets pumped through and catches all the sediment.
Can I touch it?
Yeah. You can taste it
our
too.
Buddy, it's kind of. You can eat it.
Yeah, it's just a little piece, you know. It's good. It's
it
like
filters our systems.
It'll deworm you too.
Oh God.
It's good, you know. But it's fossilized diatoms, so it's like skeletal structures of old diatoms. And
when you say don't eat a lot of it, how much is a lot?
It probably wouldn't hurt you.
That's like famous last words. Oh, no, it's really good.
Yeah. Cool. So this is one of the efficiency factors for 2021 was this pump. So the filter press is the final stage at the end of the night. Last year, this was happening, like we were filtering final product at like 8 p.m. or so, which is at the 12th hour of the workday. And it was a manual pump, and there was a lot of sweet words spoken in the sugar shop. So now we have a new pump, which is great, and it's more efficient. It's even better than we could have done it ourselves. So this was 4:30, so this was yesterday's syrup. You want to describe the colors?
Fine. Whiskey.
Whiskey. It's great with whiskey.
I don't know. It's dark honey.
Yep. It's like a light amber. Then we're still in early run here on day 9, which is awesome for the season. So we're going to enter into mid-run territory here probably pretty soon, but not yet. We're going by visual and by taste at the end of the day and judging it and putting it into the different runs.
Do you have different uses for the different runs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. I got a whole write-up on it. Our buddy Penelope and I bake, create some sort of food for the crew that helps us every morning. And this whole season I've baked with birch syrup as an ingredient. I just made a coleslaw for dinner. It's got it in it. But yeah, I'm happy to explain to folk and make suggestions on the different ways to try the early, mid, and late run. But people, I encourage them to try on their own too. Yep.
Since we've been here, this has been the third jet sled full of wood that you've brought in.
I know. I always wonder when there's not more operations in the state or in North America, but it's possibly because it's a ton of physical work. You gotta be able to actually do this, which we have friends that help make it happen for us.
So you had mentioned that your product is sold at a couple different restaurants in town?
Yep, so there's restaurants, cafes, and quite a few retail spots. It's turned into value-added products up in Anchorage and Girdwood. We've had some customers a couple years back-to-back as far south as San Francisco. I think in the bar setting for bartenders, it's super fun to work with. We have a lot of fun with that, making different concoctions. Yeah, locally, it's been put on White King salmon, squash, like in a nut squash ravioli, yeah, with a birch drizzle on it. They're on crepes. There's lattes. The Alibi is making some birch syrup chicken wings, which are pretty killer. I'm going to do a delivery to the Wild Edge. It's a newer cafe on the Spit. The creperie is utilizing it for lattes and I'm guessing on crepes as well. I just did my first delivery today to Homer Shortstop up on Baycrest. They're putting it on chicken and waffles. So, yeah. So folks are just reaching out because they know it's a spring product. And
it's so good.
It's so good.
So good for you, too. It's all your manganese for the day.
And bees, loaded with vitamin B. The farmer's market is the place that Jake and I sell it personally. Or my number's on our label on the bottle. So people, when their bottle goes empty, they pull it out of the fridge and call my cell. And I do deliveries in town and as far as Anchorage. And we do ship to Canada and the U.S. with a bottle minimum. But otherwise, around town, you can get it at the cooking store, Ulmer's, there's numerous places. I don't want to leave anybody out. Oop. That was my alarm for inside.
I was gonna ask if you had anything else that you wanted to add.
Forget anything?
Happy spring.
Happy spring?
Yep.
Kind of spring and year with weather. We've had one rainy day so far, and tomorrow's day 10. So we're really hoping for some spring weather, because this has been a lot like summer weather.
Because, yeah, you need that cold.
Cool, not necessarily cold. This morning we held off a little bit on collecting because we had some ice and slush. So it's pretty nice to have like drizzle and just moisture and yeah.
Yeah, when I woke up this morning and it was frozen, I was like, oh, the birch syrup, people are gonna be happy. And then the stupid sun came out.
We're the only ones hoping for the crappy spring weather. Well, it puts a nice twist on the spring and what it can bring.
Everyone's perception is different.
That's right, yep. I just cares what the trees think.
And that was Anna Meredith and Jake of Bridge Creek Birch Syrup. Those interviews were conducted April 30th and May the 1st, 2021. Coming up next, we're gonna hear about moose habitat and restoration.
Yeah, hey, my name is Matt James, and I work with Homer Salon and Water Conservation District here in town.
And I'm Lynn Whitmore, and I'm with Ketchmek Moose Habitat, Inc.
You guys represent two different aspects of moose habitat. I'm wondering if, Matt, you could talk about what you have been doing.
Sure. We currently have a moose habitat enhancement project going on, and it is a grant-funded through Fish and Game. We are going out and identifying local parcels of land that have been heavily browsed by moose. We are seeking local contractors to go out and do mechanical moose habitat enhancement. So that is on these projects locally is entails cutting willow.
And you, Lynn, what is your involvement with moose?
Well, our organization is from the inception from the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission causes you to mitigate for lost habitat on one of their projects. And so when Bradley Lake went in, they identified moose and goat and bear habitat as being damaged when they backed up Bradley Lake. And so for the last 23 years or so, we've been acquiring habitat properties on the lower Kenai Peninsula to help feed the moose, mostly during their tough times in the winter. So we end up targeting lowlands and wetlands quite a bit, and sometimes we target cover and corridors. And the corridors, like up above on the Homer Bench, when the moose need to migrate down, we try to keep some corridors open from development so they can have a path down through without getting disturbed, because when they're coming down for the winter browse and they're already stressed.
And what is the name of your organization?
Ketchmek Moose Habitat, Inc. It's a nonprofit.
So I was wondering if you could talk about what's happening this year specifically with the moose. A lot of people had noticed moose die-offs. They're noticing more moose in the winter down in the lower areas.
So I'll take that. This is Lynn. So what happens is we've got a fairly high population of moose right now. We've had back-to-back-to-back-to-back mild winters. Moose population has sprung up. And now we have the first heavy snowfall that we've had for quite a while in the high country. So the moose browse gets covered up, hence the moose enhancement program, helping that just coincidentally with this year's big snowfall. And so in the springtime, the yearlings that are small can't reach the tall stuff, and the snow's covering the short stuff. And so they migrate down to where they can get to some of that moose browse. And that's why you see more moose around than normal. And the die-off is a little higher than normal this year. And right now is when you see most of it, because they don't have enough green up yet to recover from that lack of food. So those moose are losing up to 25% of their body weight throughout the course of a tough winter like this. So they're stressed, and then they just don't make it. And their moms are running off the yearlings right now because they're pregnant, and this is the time of year right now that they get rid of last year's yearlings and start putting on some food for this year's calf.
So Matt, with your work that you're doing, how is cutting the willows helping moose habitat?
Yeah, well, because of the large moose population in the local area and the way they were drawn to this area for the winter browse, the browse is pretty heavily used, and it's used so hard that it doesn't give it a chance to really regenerate. And what does regenerate, the annual regeneration is very slow. And so by going and causing a disturbance, like a natural disturbance would be a wildland fire or a flood or beavers making dams and so on in the areas where there's willows. Well, with the lack of those natural disturbances, we are creating our own disturbances and cutting the willow. And we're specifically cutting the willow, treating it above the root crown to encourage sprouting annual vigorous growth off of the root base. And so that's what our intent is with this. We've identified three locations here on the Lower Peninsula that we're going to have those projects at.
Where are those three locations?
One is up off of Greer Road at the end of Tomcat in the Fritz Creek, Anchor River Fritz Creek critical habitat area. Next one would be on North Fork Road, on the south end of the North Fork along the river, and once again in the critical habitat area. And the third is along the Watermelon Trail right at the Beaver Creek crossing, about 4 miles off of Olson Mountain Road. That's the third location and is also in the critical habitat area.
Can you be more specific about your project?
Sure, I can give you the rundown of it. So when I got involved in this, there was already a moose group. That's what I call them, the moose group. It was a group of biologists, foresters, natural resource specialist type folks. I believe Lynn was involved as well. And that group developed a matrix of qualities of land that they were looking for. Then they went out and looked at a handful of parcels of land and applied that matrix to them. So the parcels that came through and scored out the best are the ones that were handed to me. And then I went out and did a field recon of those to see if one, the information that I was being given was correct. Two, is this area in dire need of a habitat enhancement? We were looking at the condition of browse. We were looking at the amount of usage by moose in these early recons. We identified our parcels and the type of treatments that we were going to do. And three parcels down on the south end were all going to be addressing the treatment of willow. And so to do that, we came up with some different ideas. And one of these ideas was just to go out and cut it. Other areas, they crush it, or they will use different types of treatment. But a lot of times in those areas, it's very, very cold in the winter when they do it, and the plants are very brittle and they shear off. Here, we don't have those types of temperatures. So we decided to go for a mechanical tile style of treatment and cutting it. We're looking at probably about a 2-year kind of recovery for that browse to start coming back with some vigorous annual growth. And that browse that does come back from that cut willow will have a lot more nutrient value than the browse did prior to the treatment. When the browse gets older, a lot of times you'll notice it doesn't have any evidence of browse on it at all. And the quality and the lack of nutrient starts going downhill as plant gets older. And the moose can tell that just by eating it, and they will avoid it. So that's what we're up to.
When the willow gets mature, it loses the percentage of nutrients in it compared to those young sprouts. And as he's seen when they're doing firefighting, and you go back a year after the big fire, like they had up along Oil Well Road and up in the cabins up there. In the following couple years, the moose were just in there heavy, and then they slowly moved out of there, migrated out of that burnt area because the timber and their cover was gone. But when that browse first comes back, it's really nutritious for the animals, so they tend to snack on it.
What else do moose eat besides willow?
They eat a variety of hardwood browse, so birch, black cottonwood, a variety of other browse species, fireweed, nuka rose.
You'll notice in the springtime, like right now, you'll see bright pieces of bark stripped off of alder and branches starting to get broken down off of some of the trees. So with the hungrier they get, the more they're trying to reach, and they'll actually reach up and break down a branch and get to the tops there. And they scrape the cadmium layer under the bark of the alders when they get really stressed, and they'll try to get some energy out of that, some vitamin B, I think.
Now, I have actually witnessed in the last couple of weeks from my house, moose in the neighborhood eating spruce trees. There's nothing available.
That's not normal.
No.
The pitch in the spruce trees is what protects the spruce trees from moose. And so they'll take a couple bites off of that, and if there's some moss hanging in it, they'll eat some of the moss that's hanging down, but it doesn't do much for them. It's pretty tough grazing. Like I said, this is the really hard time for them right now.
I know that you're a hunter and that's one of the reasons that you are so invested in moose. Do you remember years previous where there was a hunger winter?
Lots of them. Yeah, when you have a normal snowfall, which what we had this year was kind of fairly normal back in the day, they'd all come down and they all were stressed and they'd all have their die-offs and the same things happen. That's how you learn what they feed on and what their problems are is from those years past. What's what got me into the habitat business, watching them starve.
Has there been a decline in the moose population here?
It's increased because of the mild winters, basically. Some of that credit for the moose population goes to habitat enhancement. Some of it goes to Fish and Game's management of the moose herds, but most of it's due to Mother Nature and these mild winters we've had.
So because this is a gardening show, I'm sure somebody's wanting to know how to keep moose out of their garden. Any advice for that?
Tall fences.
I've seen moose get over a 6-foot tall fence. If they want what's on the other side of it, they can clamber over or break it down.
They can jump higher than 6-foot fences.
I was hoping you guys could dispel a myth. I grew up in Virginia, which is deer country, and my dad had a huge garden, and he would cut his hair and leave it around his garden in an attempt to keep away the deer. And I'm wondering if there's any truth to that or if this is just an Appalachian folk myth.
I don't know. I don't have much hair left, so I can't really try that experiment.
I've heard of that, but it wasn't in Appalachia, I just don't know if it works.
I'm guessing with a hungry moose, it probably wouldn't have any effect at all.
Okay, one question I was just thinking of for Lynn. Your group zeroes in on different areas to protect for moose habitat. Are you working towards any areas currently?
We generally try to target the beluga wetlands complex because that's where the herd comes when they're stressed. The Homer Bench herd is what it's called. And back in the early days of our organization, the Fish and Game pushed us really hard to concentrate there. And I live in Anchor Point, so I'm always, when I drive back and forth, I see a lot of animals in the river bottom. And so I thought that corridor would be more important. But what they explained to me and what they sold to me is that when the moose are really stressed, they need to come down to where I have some quiet, some peace and quiet. Sure, they get into gardens, but then there's dogs and people and cars and all that sort of thing. So there's not a lot of browse, not a big carrying capacity browse-wise in the beluga wetlands, but it's a big quiet space where we've came in and developed all around it. And that's the last remaining bastion of quiet in the Homer area. And so they migrate there and they go rest there.
To clarify, this is the area near the airport?
Yes, mm-hmm. Along Kachemak Drive, the airport on east.
Well, is there anything else that you guys wanted to add?
I would add one more thing you might want to use in this whole thing, and that's it. The Pittman-Robertson funds are what's being used for these grants, and my organization and Fish and Game is doing a grant for acquiring wildlife habitat also. But those funds come from ammunition taxes across the country, and then they get split out to the different states. The money doesn't come from fundraising or particular kitty. It comes from the taxes on ammunition. So it's going back into the moose, which is pretty cool to finally see that down here. We haven't seen too much of that I know of in this area.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a big deal that we get something back. In years past, the state of Alaska has been sending some of those funds back because they didn't have a infrastructure set up to handle it. They've been told to handle it. And so now they're starting these programs and we're seeing the results of it here. It's a grant and it has stipulations like all grants, but the grant money is coming, back from the hunters. Kind of cool.
One of the struggles around Beluga Lake, though, is that's where all the commercial lots are, like a lot of the land, and those wetlands and stuff has all been zoned commercially. So, yeah, it's like there's some definite conflicts going on there.
We watch that happen when they rezone everything. And then when you're targeting an area for just quiet and leave it alone, let alone the wetlands characters of the filtration that whole system does. You see those two major functions here. and you go to the Homer Airport and you pick up a brochure while you're waiting for a flight, and it's the City of Homer's brochure and why we're here, and it says wildlife viewing at the top. And then if wildlife viewing's at the top, then why aren't we kind of hanging on to the wildlife? And meanwhile, we're developing at a rate of 3% a year for 40 years. You do the math, there's not much left. That's why we're doing what we do, to have a little bit left for, you know, his grandkids.
It'd be nice to see a little bit of encouragement for some of these larger developments to take that into mind when they do develop their property as wildlife habitat, corridors, bedding areas, things like that, instead of just mowing down a 7-acre birch forest.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer's Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits on local agriculture and wild habitat too. First up is an announcement for local growers and ranchers who sold their products in 2019 or 2020. This includes anybody growing vegetables, fruits, flowers, nursery starts, or raises livestock, or does aquaculture shellfish. You may recall that late last year, the USDA released their CFAP2, or Coronavirus Food Assistance Program version 2, as part of the CARES Act. This was the program that was built to offer financial relief to producers due to market disruptions and associated costs because of COVID-19. Well, CFAP2 is back. Registration reopened on April 5th, and you do not need to have suffered any sales losses at all in 2020 to be eligible. It is purely based on the dollar amount you made on farm sales prior to the pandemic. CFAP2 was brought back through the American Rescue Plan Act, which included over $16 billion for agriculture relief and programs at the USDA, and this time with greater emphasis on outreach to small and socially disadvantaged producers, specialty crop, and organic producers. I have personally helped farmers with applications and can attest that these can be done in as little as 10 minutes. You just fill out the form, include what your 2019 farm sales were, or if you were a new farm in 2020, there's a slightly different process for you, and send it off to the USDA Farm Service Agency. If they have any questions, they'll contact you. Then they'll process you and cut you a check for right around 9% of the farm sales you reported. It's that easy. There are three ways to learn more or to apply. You can apply straight through an online application portal, or you can reach out directly to the Farm Service Agency office for South Central Alaska. To reach them, contact Erin Sturtevant. Her contact information can be found on their website. Or if computers aren't your thing, you can contact me. I can help you file the application. To reach me, just leave a message at the Homer Soil and Water office line at 235-8177 extension 5, or email me at nicole@homerswcd.org.
That's the show. I want to let the listening audience know that there are more ag-related events. They will be posted to KBBI's website along with this episode. Thank you to Anna Meredith and everyone at Bridge Creek Birch Syrup for talking to me about birch syrup. Lynn Whitmore and Matt James for talking to us about moose habitat restoration. Nicole Arevalo for everything that she does, along with Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Carly Konomak and Kevin Cope for our intro music. Questions and comments can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.